Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, Kellogg announced plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions from their supply chains around the globe. This is a direct result of a campaign that demanded the company be accountable for contributing to climate change. The announcement comes 2 weeks after fellow food giant General Mills announced a similar policy to set emission-cutting targets after facing a similar public pressure campaign from Oxfam. Walgreens recently announced plans to move its headquarters overseas to avoid paying U.S. taxes and then drop the plans. Fortune magazine and other media outlets reported that the company nixed the idea after an extensive review and intense public pressure. It takes people power and a lot of it to demand change from multinational corporations. Companies possess massive amounts of economic resources, making it difficult for citizens to compete. But recent success stories prove that that is not impossible. So what does it take for people to stand up to corporate injustice? What tactics make an effective corporate pressure campaign? And where have people already succeeded? Today we're joined by Nick Garoff. He's Deputy Director of Communications and Foundations at Corporate Accountability International. That's a grassroots corporate watchdog organization. And Nick joins me here in studio. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Nice to have you. And we're joined by Braden King, Associate Professor of Management and Organizations at Northwestern University Kellogg School of Management. Hi, Braden. Welcome to the show.
Having me.
Nice to have you. So, Nick, I want to start off with you. Walgreens' decision to reverse plans happened pretty quickly. And Fortune magazine and Forbes, all of the publications that cover corporations, attributed this to public pressure campaigns. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's absolutely right. For the public, this seems to have been an event that turned on a dime. But if you look at the organizing that goes into the grassroots pressure required that goes into a decision like that, chances are there's a lot behind it, from shareholder advocacy to petition drives to individual meetings between organizations and executives over long periods of time.
And what were your thoughts, Braden, on Walgreens' decision to decide not to put its headquarters overseas?
Yeah, I mean, I think this reflects this trend that you see of companies responding more and more to activist groups, to NGOs. We call this, in academia, we call this private regulation. And it really seems to be the trend versus public regulation where, you know, the government would come in and tell companies how they should behave. In this era of globalization decreased regulatory powers, activist groups seem to be the main force propelling companies to change their behaviors.
And what was it about this? I mean, so many people galvanized. Walgreens is a huge brand name, obviously. But what works? What worked in this case, would you say, Nick?
I mean, I think there's a number of things at play here. Certainly, you know, when we talk about countering the immense resources of a transnational corporation, the marketing dollars they can put into creating an image that's friendly to the public they want to sell products to. What do we have to counter that type of power? It's really masses of people coming together to call on them to take a specific course of action. But it's also the media exposure, frankly. So exposure to key audiences in particular. So the fact that their shareholders were having to wrestle with the liabilities of their moving overseas versus staying in the States was probably very significant in their decision-making. And media exposure around the fact that they were actually going to make this move and for the set of reasons that you described, that would have probably created more liability for them than it turned out to be worth.
Hmm. Well, and Braden, you spent a lot of time focusing on public perception of corporations and how the corporations really do care about how they're perceived. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's true. Companies care a lot about their reputations. One of their biggest assets today is what people think of them. You can sell, get rid of, change other kinds of assets, including, you know, the financial and material assets that they have. But what people think of you, this larger perception that the public has of you, is pretty sticky. And once something bad happens, it tends to follow you around for many years. Just think of, for example, BP and how their reputation is probably going to be changed for at least, you know, the next decade or so by what happened with the in the Gulf. And so because of that, it creates this really unique pressure point that activists can trigger when they want to influence companies' behaviors.
What would you say about public pressure? About public perception of corporations?
I mean, it's so critical, and I'll actually take an example from one of the campaigns that Corporate Accountability International is engaged with. We've seen a decline in the profitability of McDonald's, for instance, over the last few quarters. And at the same time, you see a decline in their brand affinity, especially among key constituencies like millennials. So there are these direct correlations where you have a Jim Cramer on CNBC talking about how McDonald's stock has become a junk bond. They sell junk food, and now their stock is a junk bond. And that's resulting from this perception that, and rightly so, that their food is largely junk food and unhealthy for the American public. And that sticks, and that has real-world results in terms of their profitability, and thus their willingness to change course.
Well, also, when you're talking about McDonald's, there have been these massive fast food campaigns and fast food workers going on strike across the country.
Absolutely.
And also really focusing on the salary of McDonald's CEO. It takes a McDonald's worker 4 months to earn what the CEO makes in an hour. $9,247 an hour is what James Skinner, the McDonald's CEO, makes. And I'm finding that this is you're just hearing this regularly when fast food workers go on strike.
Absolutely. And for McDonald's, the problems start at every step in the supply chain for them. So increasingly, there's an awareness that the companies that they resource their product from are engaged in the overuse of pesticides. There are animal welfare issues. And now it comes to light, certainly, that they are trying to fleece their workers out of as much money as possible to pad their profitability and returns for shareholders. And in addition, they are selling junk food to kids, one of the most aggressive marketers of junk food to kids on the planet. So all of this adds up to a very egregious situation that this corporation is going to have a difficult time getting out of unless they change course rapidly and change the perception of the company.
Hmm. What would you say about that, Braden? I mean, you've got corporate pressure campaigns involving citizens getting involved, but then you've got these corporate pressure campaigns involving the workers getting involved. And obviously, Walmart is another really good example.
Yeah, and I think in both cases, whether you're talking about everyday citizens getting involved versus workers, one of the key way in which these groups can influence the company is by creating this media attention that draws or creates negative image claims about the firm. It creates sort of a negative perception that they can't counter with what they do on a daily basis. Another kind of public perception that we haven't talked about yet is risk. Reputation obviously is very important, and it matters, and we can see that it affects the stock price of a company. But so does the perception that a company is taking on undue risk. And sometimes, worker strikes or shareholder activist proposals can have this effect of signaling to investors that there's something amiss with that company, that they're not handling their employees or their other stakeholders in an appropriate way, and that this could expose the investors to undue risk in the future. And we've in some studies that we've done, we found that things like shareholder proposals actually increase these perceptions of risk, which then lead to decreased financial performance. And I think that's one of the things that's going on with McDonald's right now.
That is Braden King, Associate Professor of Management and Organizations at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Nick Garoff is Deputy Director of Communications and Foundations at Corporate Accountability International. That's a grassroots corporate watchdog organization. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about what makes an effective and successful corporate pressure campaign. And we'd love to hear from you. We're going to talk a little bit more later in the show about successful campaigns, but if there's something that you'd like to talk about, if you were involved in a campaign, if you've been watching one, what makes you want to get involved, and what do you think is most effective? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Nick, can you also talk a little bit about how pressure campaigns have changed over the years. We recently did a show about raising awareness about sweatshops overseas and what Americans who buy those clothes can actually do. And some of the organizations say that boycotts no longer work because these corporations are just so huge now. Whereas 10 years ago, not so big, but now they're just multinationals. And even if you boycott, it's not really hitting them in their bank account. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's important to Corporate Accountability International, for instance, began with a boycott of Nestle in particular because of their infant formula marketing in the developing world, which precipitated millions of infant deaths because of the lack of water quality in these same countries. And at that time, it had a profound influence. And even today, there are openings for boycotts depending on the size, complexion of the corporation, and certainly the ability of civil society to bring enough critical mass to bear to actually have that influence. But it really is one tactic in many in terms of a strong corporate accountability campaign. So as Dr. King mentioned, shareholder advocacy is playing an increasingly important role. Media advocacy, generating the type of expose of these corporations that exposes what the discrepancy between their marketing and the reality of their practices is critically important. Direct engagement with executives and direct pressure where we're actually bringing the voices of, we're a membership organization, so critical to bring the voices of tens of thousands of people to local affiliates, local stores, to create the type of accountability necessary to leverage a change in practice.
Talk a little bit about what goes on behind the scenes. I mean, because we're talking a lot, you're doing a lot of work to take on a massive corporation, right?
Yes, indeed.
So what goes on behind the scenes?
Well, naturally, we're like many of the organizations that take on transnational corporations. We have to be very focused in terms of how we apply resources. What happens behind the scenes is not unlike folks are accustomed to from seeing the canvasser at their door, the canvasser on a street corner talking to them about an issue they should get involved with, a petition they should sign. Because we don't take money from transnational corporations, all of our support comes from members and much of the advocacy as well. And so our organizers, we're a 50-plus person team. We engage a global network of allies, and then our members are taking on any number of local campaigns to leverage change from a corporation in major cities from New York to San Francisco and beyond. And so that means that folks are sitting in church basements, they are going to school auditoriums and organizing communities of people to leverage change on a local level that in aggregate with the activities of members across the country is having a profound impact on corporate practice.
Hmm. Braden, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, there are a lot of organizations taking on corporations right now. We're going to talk about Oxfam in just a bit. And then we just got an email from Global Exchange, who put out their Most Wanted Corporate Criminals report. And so what do you think is most effective? I mean, what are you seeing out there right now that you think is most effective?
Well, one thing that we've noticed in our research is that the companies that tend to be the most targeted are the largest, most visible companies. And actually, the companies that are trying to change some of their policies in a more positive direction, they're actually more likely to be targeted than some of the lower status, less visible, but perhaps more egregious offenders of practices. And we wondered, well, why is this happening? Why is why are the Apples of the world getting targeted, even though they're not necessarily the worst offenders out there? And it appears that it's because the NGOs, the activist groups, realize that they can get a lot more bang for their buck going after a highly visible company. The media are more likely to care about it. They're more likely to then publicize the efforts of the activist groups. And it's more likely to attract the attention of the members. The people who get more excited and mobilized are more likely to mobilize when they see a company that they're familiar with. It's good for one reason. One is that it attracts media attention. Media attention is the thing that seems to then create these reputational threats that then lead to stock price declines. But it also means that there's probably a huge sort of swath of companies in the middle that are sort of going under the radar and getting away with bad stuff.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and one thing to that point, what's so critical and the reason why so much of civil society is focused on the market leader, so to speak, is because really, if you look at in the fast food industry, for example, the practices of Burger King and Wendy's and others, they're sourcing their practices, even down to how they treat their labor force, are derivative in many respects of what a McDonald's will do. And so to have a Walmart or a McDonald's shift in practice, it can have a profound influence. It basically changes the behaviors of these other corporations just by virtues of changing their supply chain and the way they do business.
Yeah, you often hear that about Walmart, especially.
Especially,
right,
yes.
Because they're so powerful. But what makes a successful campaign? I mean, workers are still fighting to get a wage increase, and they haven't yet. But this is getting attention, so much attention now. Does that make it successful, just the sheer fact that it's being talked about?
Well, I think it's one step in the right direction. Dr. King, you were going to say.
Oh, yeah, I was going to agree with you. I think that everyone involved in these campaigns, you know, has to assess change in increments rather than in categorical change, because it's just so hard to, you know, imagine, you know, shifting from, like, you know, what you want or what you have now to what you want overnight. But the other way in which these NGOs can measure success is by looking at the broader impact that it's having on public opinion and perceptions. And, again, one reason why it's smart to go after the market leader, the highly visible company, is because that's a bigger public stage, right? And so if you think of these companies not just as targets or as actors or organizations that you would like to, you know, change their behavior, but also as public stages where you can broadcast your, you know, your grievances broadly, then, you know, it is smart to go after the big companies, and you're more likely to have an effect on public opinion by doing that than by going after, you know, a company that no one really notices or cares about.
But it's much harder, right, because they're so big, or is it?
No, I think it's easier. Well, it's harder to get maybe some of the changes you want, but it's easier to attract the attention that you want by going after the larger companies.
That's absolutely right. What's interesting as the media landscape shifts is that you do have dedicated journalists for many of these major industry players. So folks who are following Walmart, Target, McDonald's, Comcast, a workforce of journalists who are dedicated to following their every financial move and beyond, where newsrooms are shifting people out of covering public interest stories, human interest stories, because there just isn't the bandwidth. That capacity remains, and so there is someone on the other end of the phone to talk to about these corporations where there isn't on so many other issues that we care about when we talk about the public interest.
Yeah, that's a really good point. One other point about this is that you go after the companies that are not just bigger, but that also have these channels through which you can address the changes. Not all companies out there even have somebody who's appointed to be, you know, the corporate citizenship or corporate responsibility executive. But these larger companies have, you know, almost all of them now have those in place. And so it gives a channel, a medium through which activists can express themselves.
Yeah. Braden, what strikes you about that? Because we often hear this sort of corporate responsibility. And as you said, most major corporations have them now. They've got nice, glossy websites talking about what they do to give back. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, if you think of this as incremental change, I think it's moving in the right direction. I don't think that a company, you know, saying that it is socially responsible means that it is. I mean, I think we have to take it with a grain of salt, because so much of this is about public relations, you know, managing their reputation. On the other hand, it appears that when companies start to make moves in the direction of trying to be more attentive to civil society, to NGOs, activist groups, that it actually does make them more responsive in the future. So a project that I have with a student right now, we find that, you know, after a company establishes a corporate social responsibility committee, or after they start issuing these social responsibility reports, they actually become more responsive in the future to these activist groups that are demanding things of them. One reason is because it, you know, creates the channel. Now there are people in place who the activists can go to and complain to when they have problems. But it also creates a need or an ideal within the company that this is something we should be doing. Maybe 20, 30 years ago, this wasn't even on the radar of many companies.
That is Braden King, Associate Professor of Management and Organizations at Northwestern University Kellogg School of Management. Nick Garoff is Deputy Director of Communications at Corporate Accountability International. That's a grassroots corporate watchdog organization. And today we are talking about what makes an effective and successful corporate pressure campaign. Were you paying attention to Walgreens after it announced plans to move its headquarters overseas to avoid paying taxes? It quickly dropped those plans, and major media outlets said it was mainly because of intense public pressure. So what are your thoughts on what makes an effective campaign? If you've been involved in one, we'd love to hear from you. What would make you get involved in one? And then also, how do these campaigns maybe change your views about corporations? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I'd love to hear from you if you have thoughts on how movements against corporations have really changed over the years, because now we've got massive multinational corporations that have headquarters, or I should say offices, in many different countries around the world. So what's really changed? 866-798-8255. And Nick, I wanted to ask you, when a company is interested in actually engaging, like, for example, we're going to talk with someone from Oxfam in about 10 minutes, and they got Kellogg and General Mills to cut greenhouse gas emissions after they came out with a report that shamed the top 10 food companies. What happens when a corporation says, okay, we want to play ball here, we're interested in talking?
Well, a number of things, and I'll provide one example from our history, which I think is instructive. During the late 1980s, corporate accountability was involved in a boycott of General Electric. And General Electric was at that time the lead manufacturer, private manufacturer of nuclear weapons. And Jack Welch, who, if folks watch 30 Rock, gets a great deal of mention, was the CEO at the time and a devout Catholic. And we were able to get him to the table by virtue of Catholic Healthcare Association saying, hey, you know what? We aren't going to buy General Electric products until you get out of the nuclear weapons business. Mm-hmm. And he sent a private charter jet to pick up a set of nuns and fly them to the corporate headquarters. And so those are the moments you look for in terms of leveraging corporate behavior. And they were able to have a direct interaction with him and tell him in no uncertain terms they needed to stop this practice. And within a number of years, they were out of the business. It took a number of other factors to move that, but that was the thing that got his attention. So once you have their attention in a very real way, because as we talked about earlier, there are these intermediaries, the CSR executives and others, who are oftentimes running interference for executives. But when you get the true decision maker's attention, that's the point where you're coming with concrete policies and a means of implementing those policies for the corporation and working to figure those out.
And after the break, I'd like to also ask you how, you know, at what point do you decide that the company is actually going to take real action and not just do what we now call greenwashing? And at what point do you tell your members, hey, this was a success, please go thank this company? Because I've seen a lot of emails like that. Today we're talking about successful and effective corporate pressure campaigns, and we'd love to hear from you. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
There are lots of ways to take part in our conversation this morning on Your Call, on the phone, or you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or you can just leave a message on the website, yourcallradio.org. The call-in number, toll-free, 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say. Following that today at noon, it's Bina here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we'll discuss media coverage of President Obama's decision to authorize airstrikes against ISIS in northern Iraq. We will also talk about coverage of Iraq's humanitarian and political crisis and the ouster of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. And then next week, we are putting shows together about what determines what drugs get made and how much they'll cost. We talked about this last Friday, the fact that there are no cures for Ebola because it doesn't bring in profit. So we're going to talk about how that works. And then we'll also talk about how young people are beating the odds and finishing high school and graduating from college. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what makes an effective corporate pressure campaign. There have been quite a few, actually, recently. Walgreens dropped plans to move headquarters overseas to avoid paying taxes, largely due to intense public pressure. You've got magazines like Fortune saying that was the reason. And then Kellogg and General Mills announced plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions after a damning Oxfam report called out the Big Ten food companies for significant greenhouse gas emissions. So what are your thoughts on this? What makes an effective corporate pressure campaign? Have you been involved in one? What would get you involved? And then as you watch these things unfold, what really changes your opinion of corporations or think, wow, I think they're actually going to be successful? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Scott in San Francisco. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show. Do we have Scott? Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on a comment that was made earlier about the trend away from governmental regulation toward private. And I think that's a good thing, but it's a sort of a dicey comment to make. I'd hate for people to get the idea that government regulation is not still a bedrock in terms of policing these organizations, everything from the EPA to Wall Street regulation, to tax code issues. I know there's not a lot of teeth right now, and it's difficult to get things done, but thinking solely in terms of private regulation, I think might be a dangerous thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's
Nick?
A really great point, Scott.
Go ahead, Nick.
I was going to say that...
Go ahead.
Great, Mom.
Yeah.
Scott, I was going to say that's a very good point, and I think the spirit of it is frankly, that the atmosphere in Washington has created the conditions for this. Mm. And groups like ours, you know, are very concerned, frankly, about regulation as an end game. Because the way we think about what's necessary in terms of true checks on corporate power is, you know, we can create the circumstances for policy. These campaigns can create the circumstances for regulatory bodies that have a great deal more influence and long-lasting control over these circumstances than any civil society organization could have. And so, for example, we ran and continue to run a tobacco campaign where we created the public climate and circumstances for all the smoke-free places and other tobacco controls you see today. But the culmination of that campaigning was a global regulatory regimen called the Global Tobacco Treaty, which across 175-plus countries makes sure that these are transnationals now, so regulation needs to happen across borders. It sets up the ability of international government to regulate the tobacco industry, no matter where it goes across the globe, to make sure people's health are protected in the end game.
And Braden, what would you add to that? It's an interesting point.
Yeah, since I was the one who said the dicey comment, I should say something as well. I think I definitely share this concern. I think that, you know, we can't, NGOs and activist groups can't abandon the idea that government should play a role in this as well. I think the difficulties stem from, as Nick said, the fact that Washington itself is not very proactive in doing this at the moment. But also the fact that these companies span so many different regulatory systems, it's hard to find a way to get convergence on what is expected across countries. And many countries are just simply unwilling to offer any kind of regulation with teeth. And so given those constraints, you know, what is the next best option? I think that there are some dangers, of course, of going only this route. I'll just give one example of why it's dangerous, and that is that there is a race to the bottom in sort of the world of private regulation as well as in public regulation. If you look at certification systems as an example of how companies oftentimes try to say, hey, we're regulating ourselves because we've adopted this label that shows that we are environmentally friendly or that we use the right kind of labor. This is sometimes used as sort of a way to voluntarily say that we're regulating ourselves. But the truth is that there's not a lot of oversight of these certification systems. And in fact, right now, there are over 600 different labels or certifications for being environmentally sustainable or being a green-friendly company. And if you look across the 600 labels, a lot of them are pretty shady. You know, there are some lots of labels, probably more labels than not, that allow companies to say they're green without requiring them to do any sort of change whatsoever. And so the proliferation of these certification systems has really created a struggle among consumers and other groups to figure out, who really is green and who is just claiming that they are.
Right. And we did a show about that a couple months ago, because when you buy food now, you could have up to 10 labels on the back of a product. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And now I would like to welcome Chris Jochnik to the show. Chris is director of the private sector department at Oxfam America, the United States branch of Oxfam dedicated to finding solutions to poverty, hunger, and social injustice. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Nice to have you. So Oxfam has been doing this kind of work for a long time, and you regularly put out reports. Your latest one called out the Big Ten food companies for significant greenhouse gas emissions. And so far, Kellogg and General Mills have responded by announcing plans to disclose greenhouse emission targets. So to talk about that process, what happens when you put the report out? Do you directly hear from the corporation? How does that work?
Yeah, well, the report coming out is based on a long period of engagement with the companies themselves. So this campaign actually was launched a year and a half ago, called Behind the Brands. People can quickly pull it up on their website, behindthebrands.org. And the first thing we did was we reached out to the companies. We told them it was coming. We developed a set of indicators around a number of different issues, water, labor issues, farm workers, all of about how companies address these kinds of issues in their supply chains. And amongst those issues, greenhouse gas emissions was one of the ones that we wanted to focus our attention on. So by the time that we issued the report that you just mentioned, we've already been in touch with the companies now for quite a while. We've put a lot of pressure on them publicly. We've gotten investors involved. We've gotten consumers and the public involved, lots of media. And so when the report came out, what we were trying to do with this particular issue was focus on the fact that the ag sector, the food and beverage companies and their supply chains, have an enormous impact on greenhouse gas emissions and on climate change, but they've been generally neglected with almost all the attention just focused on the, for good reason, on the fossil fuel sector, which is the largest driver. But just looking at the ag sector, there's about 25% of overall global emissions are coming out of the ag sector, and so we wanted to put more attention on that. And specifically, we wanted to look at how companies were addressing not just greenhouse gas emissions in their own operations, but how they were addressing them in their supply chain, because we know that that's where the bulk of the emissions are. And so that report pushed the 10 companies to step up and look beyond just their own operations and start reporting on emissions throughout their supply chains. And we focused specifically on Kellogg and General Mills, because those were two laggards. And then we push them to make sort of leadership-type commitments to addressing those the issues throughout their supply chains, which they did. And as you say, I guess this what would be most interesting is just thinking about what makes a company like a General Mills or a Kellogg, which was reluctant really to engage with us at first, then step up and do something that is really beyond their comfort zone. And I think what does drive companies like that is the fact that they're very vulnerable to public and consumer pressure. Their reputations are enormously valuable. And with social media, which we depend on a lot, and with a number of, we got something like 230,000 people to reach out to the companies.
Oh, wow.
With that kind of critical mass, these companies can be pushed to really step up and take positions that they normally wouldn't consider doing, and that's what we saw in the case of both of these companies.
So you put the report out and then asked your members, maybe went on Twitter, I'm sure, and Facebook, and asked citizens to then put the pressure on General Mills and Kellogg to say, hey, we've read this report, and we know you're not doing the right thing?
Exactly. And so that's one piece of the leverage. I'd say that's the most important. But there's also, you know, we get the media involved, of course, and we also... We do direct action, so we'll go to the headquarters and try to get their own employees and staff, you know, people at the headquarters thinking about it, and that can often be effective. We know that employees will talk about it on their intranet inside the company. We'll put some pressure on people. We'll want to know more. That's always a useful piece of leverage. And then the other part is the investors. We get the investor community also, shareholders and large institutional investors, to also put some pressure on the company. So you have these various prongs, but I think in this case, social media has made it much easier to get large numbers of consumers and just general public to reach out, and that's been really effective.
And this is a big deal. I mean, Kellogg's is promising to release its greenhouse gas emission targets by December next year and also reveal its top three palm oil, soy, and sugarcane suppliers. At what point do you say, all right, citizens, we did it. We got them to do what we wanted. At what point do you decide to say something nice about the company?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think the discussion you were just having just before I came in about private regulation is really important. And I would agree with your other guests that we can't depend entirely on private regulation, and there's definitely a downside, which it can often be a distraction, or it can be just, you know, a greenwash. So we always want to maintain some level of vigilance and public attention to you know, ensure that there's accountability even with these private regulatory type regimes. So when the companies make these kinds of commitments, we want to celebrate the fact that they are stepping up, they're making the commitments. We want to ensure that the commitments include concrete steps to be more transparent. So just naming their top suppliers doesn't seem like much, but in fact, there's so much hidden about these supply chains that getting that first level of suppliers is really important. So that also, you know, increasing the transparency and then getting very firm commitments that we can then follow up on. So if Kellogg and General Mills don't comply with the commitments they've made by the dates that we've all agreed on, then we can ramp up the attention again. So we do celebrate them, but that's not the end of the road. We do want to also ensure that there's ongoing vigilance around these issues.
Right. And to that point, we have an email from Armand who says, who's watching these corporations that claim they're going greener to see if they're actually doing something or anything in a meaningful way? I won't believe it until I have real measurable proof. So are you going to check?
That's a really important point.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if we saw more consumers and more people from the public asking those kinds of questions, we would be in better shape. Our role, I think, as NGOs is to increase the opportunities for the public and for shareholders and consumers to get the kind of information they need and then to try to rally them to put more pressure on the companies. So it's not going to be Oxfam at the end of the day. We can help, but really we rely on, you know, all kinds of other constituencies as well as other NGOs so that there's, you know, widespread understanding about the impact, about the role of the companies, more transparency, and that will then hopefully lead to more accountability. And all of it should be very much also focused on governments. And so one of the commitments that we always push companies on, and we always, you know, that's part of any agreement that we come to with companies, is that they will become public champions for whatever they've committed to doing. So we want to ensure that they're not making commitments on the one hand for their own operations and then behind the scenes working with lobbyists to undercut those kinds of commitments. And so in this case, General Mills and Kellogg have both agreed to step up and push for stronger oversight from governments, from the U.S. government and from others, which is, you know, really important as well.
That is Chris Jochnik, Director of Private Sector Department at Oxfam America. Again, they came out with a report that called out the Big Ten food companies for significant greenhouse gas emissions, and Kellogg and General Mills responded by announcing plans to disclose emission targets. So we're talking about that with Chris, and then we're also joined today by Nick Garoff, Deputy Director of Communications at Corporate Accountability International, a grassroots corporate watchdog organization. and we will talk about their campaign to try to get cities to ban the sale of plastic water bottles, specifically in San Francisco, and Braden King, Associate Professor of Management and Organizations at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Today we're talking about what makes an effective and successful corporate pressure campaign. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Rebecca writes, I heard about Walgreens' plans on your station. Thank you. I was so offended, as I am, by these corporations who think that they are so successful that they can move their headquarters overseas so they can keep as much money as possible. I wrote Walgreens, who I've been a loyal customer of for 25 years, and told them what I thought. It feels so good that this may have made a difference. And I'm so glad you wrote in, Rebecca, because Nick, you know, on our show, we never end by saying, what can we do? And usually the guest says, call your congressperson. And we say, what else can we do? But what would you say is most effective? I mean, it's really great to hear that social media is really effective, posting a tweet, posting something on Facebook, writing a letter to these corporations.
Yes, absolutely. To start with social media, what's intriguing is if you look at many of the largest corporations, most abusive corporations in their industries oftentimes, you're seeing that they're hiring digital program directors. And they're also running these hubs for social media activity, which are geared at monitoring groups like Corporate Accountability International, Oxfam, and everyday citizens who are critical of the abuses that these corporations are perpetuating. So recent stories on Nestle having a hub in Europe to this effect is just the tip of the iceberg. McDonald's hiring a digital program officer. They care immensely about their reputation in this space. And they are fledgling in this space as well, because it is open, it is democratic. And so when they put out marketing campaigns in Facebook or especially the Twitter space, oftentimes they're being co-opted by folks who know better about what their product is. Generally speaking, there are less individuals in that space who want to herald how well the corporation is doing, and more folks who are mindful of what the abuses are, what they look like. And there's a really legitimate way of broadcasting to your network, hey, you know what, there's a hashtag out there, this company is trying to promote, greenwash this product or this practice. It's a very easy way to weigh in and create true accountability for these corporations.
You know, what just came to mind is the Blackfish documentary about captive orcas at SeaWorld, and there's a massive Twitter campaign calling out SeaWorld for this, and SeaWorld's actually getting involved, engaging with people, and their stock continues to go down as a result.
Absolutely.
Have you been following that?
To some extent, yes. It's and there's, you know, I think if you go on Twitter, there's actually all sorts of great stories on, you know, the SeaWorld story. McDonald's had a McD story hashtag that went harmfully awry, and so the public is taking these hashtags and twisting them to their own democratic purpose.
It's also interesting to see the corporation respond directly to people on Twitter and engage with people.
It's a clear signal of their vulnerability in this space.
Braden, I mean, that's the other thing that social media has changed. When did we ever, you know, have a corporation talk directly to a citizen about these issues?
Yeah, not in real time like we see today. I think social media is a game changer in a lot of ways. There are some, you know, things that, you know, we should worry or be concerned about a little bit with how social media is used. I'll just give you one example. There was a study that showed recently that when people engage in social media, specifically joining a Facebook page that says they support a social cause, they are actually less likely to do anything about it consequently. So if they like the page, and if their friends can see that they like the page, they're less likely to actually go out and volunteer to stuff envelopes compared to people who didn't like the page. And one reason that may be happening is that people, when they engage primarily through social media, they're satisfying this own kind of internal need to look good in front of their friends, and that's one reason why people engage in activism, is because it makes them feel good that they're doing something. So once that need has been satisfied, they may not sort of follow through with it and actually do something else to further the cause. And so NGOs, activist groups need to be aware that there need to be multiple points at which they can connect with these people, not just through Twitter. And that brings up one other weakness, as I think the emailer raised this, which is that one of the, I think the real weaknesses in civil society right now are the lack of groups on the ground that are doing monitoring. This really matters, especially in third world countries where we don't have as many kind of active NGOs, and where you are more likely to see abuses and more likely to see the greenwashing going on. So a company can say, yeah, we've instituted new changes that are going to improve our factory conditions. But when you actually go in and look at them, it probably, you know, many times it's the case that they haven't really changed those conditions. And so if people are only engaging in Twitter and social media and they're not on the ground doing this really hard, dirty work of monitoring, then it's not clear that we're going to actually see that full level of accountability we expect.
Well, and even that is getting more attention, right? The fact that a corporation will say they're doing one thing, but when you go into the factory, in fact, they're not. And it usually takes an undercover investigator to find that information.
Or you can have mobilized activist grassroots groups in those countries that they understand that their purpose is to hang around the factory conditions and do, and it's risky work. It's not easy, but it's really necessary to see these changes take place.
And just quickly, Braden, I understand that you also follow stock, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are about SeaWorld. I just looked this up, and David Kirby of TakePart wrote that SeaWorld rocked the financial world on Wednesday when its stock price dropped by 35% to a record low. The company blamed its woes in part on protests against its orca shows.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't know that, but it makes a lot of sense. I mean, so much of SeaWorld's value comes from its reputation as this family-friendly place, and if that's being undermined by, you know, these changing perceptions about how they treat orcas and other animals, then it's going to affect their, you know, value, their market value going into the future, and it also makes them a more risky investment, right? So if things get even crazier, or you have one more accident with an orca, you know, investors could be, you know, seeing the stock price plummet even further.
Well, let's take a few calls before we have to end here, and we'll get responses from our guests. Let's go to Jason in Salinas. Hi, Jason.
Hi, I just have a quick question for the panel to answer. With this increased pressure from the media and the public on multinational corporations, what do the panelists think is happening in terms of the quality and quantity of watchdogging of smaller corporations and companies? Mm. And I'll take my answer offline.
Great, thank you. We'll get to that in just a minute. Let me take one more call. Let's hear from Jerry in Oakland. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, I'm interested in internet neutrality and how these large corporations are trying to monopolize that aspect of the internet and the robocalls. You know, when you call a large corporation or even some public agencies and you get these robocalls, press one for this, two for that, three for that, none of them are pertaining to what you want to call for, and then they say press menu, go right back. Can we do something about that and make laws so that if a corporation is a certain size, you should talk to a human body, which is a job, rather than a robocall where they're saving money? And these large media corporations like AT&T and Comcast, my son just got me a flat screen TV. I'm not a big TV, but he got me a flat screen TV because he wanted to be up to date. And then I got the color. I said, well, the color's not. He said, well, you got to call Comcast to get the high def thing. And they're going to charge me $10 a month extra.
Oh, wow.
Just high def. And that's a ripoff. Just think of the millions of people paying $10 a month just for high def, you know, and this is where the ripoff is, and I think these are the areas that and also the post office. They're trying to destroy the post office. I work for the post office, and they're trying to get neutralize the post office, and you can't even get through to the post office because they have the same problem.
Jerry, thank you so much for calling. Try to hit zero. That's what I always try to do, just to bypass all that stuff. In some cases, you have to go online and actually now chat with someone in another country. But just quickly, what about Jason's call? Who's keeping track of the smaller corporations with so much attention on companies like Walmart and McDonald's? Who'd like to take that?
So, can I jump in on that one?
Sure.
I think it's a great question. It also begs a bigger question about all of the companies that don't have well-known brands. A lot of companies, the majority of companies are not well-known to consumers and are not easily touched by these kinds of campaigns. And so
I think what it reinforces is that these campaigns against well-known consumer-facing companies like McDonald's or SeaWorld or Coca-Cola or whatever it is can be helpful in pushing for, you know, some changes along the supply chains, which will pick up some smaller companies. But really, at the end of the day, they're only going to be scalable and sustainable if they also, at the same time, are reinforcing stronger government oversight on the one hand and stronger citizen engagement on the other. And so I think all of these corporate campaigns have to always be mindful about that as the longer-term objective, that we need stronger government enforcement of laws, and we need an engaged public. That's the only way. And an engaged public in developing countries, as your prior speaker was mentioning. We need strong civil society groups working in those countries to also be effectively monitoring and tied in through global networks with groups in the North. And that has been largely neglected, especially by funders. We're not seeing enough money being channeled to those kinds of groups to help build their capacity. But that's really where I think the next big challenge for us is, how do we build those stronger civil society groups in developing countries where a lot of these problems are happening.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Jason. And Jerry, I was taking notes when you called. I think this would require actually another show. You brought up some really good points. So thank you for calling in. That is Chris Jochnik. He's Director of Private Sector Department at Oxfam America. You can find more information about their report that called out the Big Ten food companies for greenhouse gas emissions. Kellogg and General Mills responded by saying they will disclose targets. Nick Garoff is Deputy Director of Communications and Foundations at Corporate Accountability International. They worked on a successful campaign to ban the sale of plastic water bottles on public property in San Francisco. That'll start in October of this year. And then Braden King is Associate Professor of Management and Organizations at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Thank you all for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of President Obama's decision to authorize airstrikes against ISIS positions in northern Iraq. He's calling this a long-term project. We'll also talk about media coverage of Iraq's humanitarian and political crisis and the ouster of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. We'll be joined by The Guardian's Martin Chulov and McClatchy's Jonathan Lande. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.